I was fortunate to grow up in South Louisiana, which you may not think is fortunate, but I had a great time there. Thank you very much. And I grew up on an unused farm. It was a farm that had no longer in use. There was no cows, no goats, no chickens, no nothing. Just a lot of space. 300 acres of it, in fact. Now, for a kid, especially a young adolescent male, that is heaven. Come summertime, you get out, you roam about in the woods, because there was like 200 acres of woods out behind that, so I figured that I had life twice as good as Christopher Robin, although I never did find Eeyore or Tigger. I had a great time back out there, and I'd head back out into the woods, and I would, you know, take off in the morning, I'd head out, bring like lunch with me sometimes, not come back till the sunset. Totally not what parents let kids do nowadays. They're all super protective, you know. No, you have to wear a helmet. You know, Mom, I look like a dork. Well, you're going to look like a safe dork. And, you know, I'd go out there. I'd be playing with rusty nails and stuff. I mean, it was insane. Anyway, I loved growing up. Now, maybe that was a South Louisiana thing and not so much a generational thing. I don't know. No one's ever accused the Cajuns of producing many Nobel laureates. So we got out there into the woods. My brother and I would often head back out. And there was a couple places I loved to go. There was a pond. There was this. There was that. One of the places I enjoyed going was this place. There was a little bitty creek. At the time, my brother and I called it a river. In retrospect, it was pretty puny, really itty-bitty. So I'll call it a creek now. Muddy, nasty little bayou wannabe thing running down in this little gully. And there was a railroad track that ran through Millie's Woods. And over the creek, there was a bridge the railroad track built. Now, for a boy, a young boy, a bridge over water is just heaven on earth. So my brother got there, we'd play, we'd have a great time, you know, we'd do different things involving pirates and planks and forts and whatnot. It was a hootenanny of a time, if you'll permit the expression. One day my brother and I are out there, and we're looking for something to do. We've exhausted all the immediately obvious possibilities of the surrounding environment. And so we decide that what we're going to do is we kind of look at the way the rock run, not the rock, the wall runs underneath the bridge, and we notice there's a little ledge that juts out, like 2 or 3 inches. So we figure we'll pretend we're mountain goats and try to like work our way along it. Now, there are three problems with this plan. One, we are not mountain goats. Two, that's not rock, that's clay. There are hardly any rocks in Louisiana. Most of you grew up in states where the ground is hard beneath you. I could probably dig a 20-foot hole in Louisiana and not hit a single rock. Louisiana is one glorified flat on the Mississippi River, which is like a delta that just kept growing. It's nothing but sediment and silt from all the northern states. And so it's just clay. Solid clay, problem number two. We're not mountain goats, problem number two, solid clay. Problem number three, our feet are wet from playing in the water. So we're walking along with wet feet, and this is a recipe for disaster. And disaster does strike my younger brother, Greg. Greg's walking along, sploosh, falls right into the water. Now, he encountered three problems also. Number one, he was not expecting to fall into the water, so he did not take a breath on the way down. Number two, he was wearing all his clothes. He wasn't dressed for swimming. He had his boots on and stuff, so it's not easy to swim in that sort of environment. Number three, the water is nasty. Stank, nasty water. You can't see more than 2 inches in it. If you were to open your eyes, first, you'd probably get an eye disease. Second, you wouldn't be able to see anything. And when my brother finally breaks surface and grabs for something that's floating in desperation, he grabs, I kid you not, the bloated carcass of a dead mammal. Its belly distended with gas that was floating in the water. And so he's like, ah, let it float, let go, let it float, let go, let it float, let go. Now, my brother was in a pickle. He felt, I could see it all over his face, he felt overwhelmed. In a literal sense, he was overwhelmed by his environment. He was sinking into the muddy water, and he was convinced he was going to die. Now, in reality, his situation was not that dire. A couple reasons for that. It was an itty-bitty creek. It would have been impossible for him to fall more than 4 feet from a bank. No matter if he had timed it end it perfectly, in the dead center, he still would have been within 4 feet of one of the banks. Number two, the water's shallow enough. Even if you can't swim, you can bounce down to the bottom and, you know, just sort of shoot your way over to the side. It'll be a piece of cake. Number three, I'm his older brother, and I'm there to help him out and to stick a stick out and to haul him out of the water. He was not actually in a great deal of peril, but he couldn't appreciate that. Rational arguments are rarely any good when you're having an emotional trauma. Have you noticed that? My brother felt overwhelmed. It reminds me of something that happened just yesterday to me. This week, my wife and I were hosting a missionary to Europe, John Cashel, for about 20, 25 years now. He's been doing ministry to colleges in Northern Europe, primarily Germany. Travels around the world, usually in 2 to 12 countries a month, ranging from South America to Africa to different nations in China, in Asia. And just all over the world, doing amazing ministry. Really neat guy. Some of you got to meet him. If you did get to meet him, he's going to be here Sunday night, and I'd be happy to introduce you just for a little bit before he goes to bed and flies out for God knows where next. Anyway, I decided to give him a little bit of downtime and show him around the campus. We have a pretty scenic campus. Went to the top of Hoover Tower. Beautiful, gorgeous day. Even though it was raining, it created a very neat effect with the light. Went down. We also decided to go to the Cantor Art Center. Now, it was Tuesday, so the art center itself was closed. The museum was closed. But the Rodin Sculpture Garden's open, right? And I figure he's an art guy. He's from Europe, you know. All Europeans are art guys. I don't know where I got that in my head. But he told me he was. So, you know, I figured, the Louvre and whatnot. And so we go over, and he's looking at them, and he's like, oh, these are great. So amazing. Can't believe they're all outside in the rain. I'm like, well, usually it's not raining. And I was just thinking in the back of my head, man, I wish this thing was open so I could take him inside. So I noticed right away when this college student, female college student, began walking up towards the main doors. I thought, I'm going to wait and see if she gets in. She walks up to the door. And walks away. And she passes by and says, excuse me, I couldn't help you notice and tried the door. Looks like you weren't able to get in. Did the sign say the building was closed? She's like, yeah. So that's what I thought. You might want to try again tomorrow. I believe it's open Wednesday to Sunday. She said, I know the schedule. I know the schedule. I just couldn't remember the day. I didn't know today was Tuesday. And she just had this look on her face. And I thought in the back of my mind, this gal is overwhelmed. She was pulling a couple of all-nighters or something. She had so many problems pushing down on her in life, she couldn't even remember what day of the week it was. And my sense is, she's not alone in this room. Now, maybe you know what day of the week it was. Obviously, you made it here on a Wednesday night. So you're the few, the proud, the Chi Alphans. Way to go. But many of you, you expressed massive sympathy when I was praying earlier about deliver me. talking about feeling stressed and overwhelmed. Being overwhelmed is a very common problem in life. In fact, stress is almost the default state for most students at Stanford, in my experience talking to them. Now, stress, in fact, is probably the default state for most people living in North America. You go into any group of people, you ask them who here feels a level of stress, at least 80% of the hands in the room will probably go up, no matter what group you walk into. You know, retired nuns, who feels stressed? Boom, hands go up. Now, this creates a problem for most Christians. And the problem is this. Almost no translation of the Bible talks about the word stress. Very few translations include the word stress. It's a common part of our lives, but it doesn't seem to be in the Bible. Why is that? Well, it's not that surprising. You see, the word stress was never applied to people until 1950, when a scientist named Hans Ehrle, I think. I wrote his name down. Doesn't matter. Dr. Hans, we'll call him. Dr. Hans decided that there was this condition that people were facing that needed a name. And so he just took the name he could figure out that best approximated it from engineering and called it stress. Now, it turns out that no other language on the earth, I exaggerate slightly, almost no other language on earth had a comparable word that already exists in its vocabulary. Not French, they call it le stress. not Spanish, not Arabic, not Chinese, not Japanese. All these languages lacked this precise word with the meaning that he was getting at. And so they all basically just imported a phonetic equivalent of the word stress into their language. And so it shouldn't surprise us that ancient Hebrew had no precise equivalent either. It's a novel concept, probably due to the changing nature of the environment in which people find themselves, that now we experience this emotion so much more frequently. But there are counterparts in the Bible if you know how to look for them. For example, the word overwhelmed. That is a word that has got much biblical parlance, and that also is very, very parallel to the subject that we mean when we talk about stress. Another word might be harassed, harried, helpless. You look for these words in the Bible, and you begin to find God's guidance on how to deal with stress. I put some meditation verses in the middle of your handout there for you to look at. But the most common way the Bible talks about stress is indirectly. Not by using a key word that clues you into it, but by using an extended metaphor. I mean, the word stress itself is a metaphor. You understand that, right? It's a metaphor for us undergoing pressures from outside of us, just like a building or a girder might undergo. We undergo psychic forces, not psychic in the sense of Miss Cleo, but psychic in the sense of mental forces that weigh upon us and oppress us in the same way that a girder might experience the force of gravity or the pressure from something hitting it on the side. Now, there's a lot of Psalms that talk about stress fairly directly. For example, there's Psalm 22, I believe, Psalm 122. I think Psalm 4 hits on it. I have this in my notes. Psalm 4, Psalm 121. Tonight, I want to talk about Psalm 46. I wrote it down for you in two translations. I'm going to use the Good News translation on the left side of the page for most of tonight's talk, but I wanted to put the New Revised Standard Version in there for a specific reason. The Good News translation did not translate a very particular word, Selah. That is a word that appears again and again and again in the Psalms. The reason the Good News translation didn't put it in is because we, A, don't know what it means with precision. We are very confident that it has to do with musical direction. It's something about the way the song would be sung. The Good News translators figured no one's singing this song, so it doesn't really matter about that particular word. We'll just put a paragraph break there, and that will accomplish the same goal. It will create the logical division. I wanted to put the word Selah in there because I think it communicates something important about the structure of this song. The best equivalent that you might find in today's music to Selah is guitar solo here. Except it would be more like, you know, Josiah, get jiggy with the shofar, for Yahweh is in the house tonight, you know, and he's and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the Good News translation of Psalm 46, except where Selah is in the New Revised Standard Version, I'm going to go ahead and bring that in my own style. God is our shelter and strength, always ready to help in times of trouble. So we will not be afraid, even if the earth is shaken and mountains fall into the ocean depths, even if the seas roar in rage and the hills are shaken by the violence. Selah. Josiah, get jiggy with it. Because God is our shelter and our strength. There is a river that brings joy to the city of God, to the sacred house of the Most High. God is in that city and it will never be destroyed. At early dawn, he will come to its aid. Nations are terrified. Kingdoms are shaken. God thunders and the earth dissolves. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Josiah, go wild. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come and see what the Lord has done. See what amazing things he has done on earth. He stops wars all over the world. He breaks bows, destroys spears, and sets shields on fire. Stop fighting, he says, and know that I am God, supreme among the nations, supreme over the world. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Josiah, go crazy, man. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Now, instead of breaking this psalm down verse by verse, as I typically have been doing this quarter, instead, I want to approach it from a different angle. I want to highlight a few key themes in the psalm that are going to be practical and relevant for our life today. And I think by looking at the whole rather than the parts, we'll get a better sense of what God wants to say to us tonight. Building block number one from this psalm. This psalm is an extended metaphor. And it's a metaphor for what we today would call stress or being overwhelmed, having our worlds been out of control. How do I know that? How do I know that it's metaphorical and not literal? Here are the clues that I see in the text and I want to direct your attention to as well. First, the middle stanza. You can tell that the middle stanza is metaphorical simply by looking at two things. There's a reference to the city of God, right? Well, literally in the Bible, the city of God is always Jerusalem. There is no other city in the Bible, physical city, that is the city of God. However, we know that this is not talking about Jerusalem for two reasons. Number one, there is no river that runs through Jerusalem. Don't know if you've ever been there, but there's no river. Never has been a river. Jerusalem is not in a place where a river runs through it. So when it says a river runs through the city, at least you have to take the river metaphorically. There's another reason we should take the city metaphorically as well. It says that this city will never fall, right? Jerusalem has been conquered many, many, many times. In fact, it may bear the distinction of being the most conquered city on the planet. I'm not sure. I probably exaggerate, but it's been conquered a lot. And it had been conquered several times at the time this psalm was written. Clearly, the psalmist, the person who put this psalm together, was not referring to the city of Jerusalem or to a literal river. It's metaphorical in the middle stanza. The first stanza is metaphorical. We can tell that because of how over the top it all is. Okay, we live in earthquake zone here, right? About, what, 15, 20 years ago, the Loma Prieta earthquake hit. Knocked down a million books out of the libraries here. They had to be put up. Man, work-study sucked that semester. That quarter, rather. We know earthquakes. I've never heard of a mountain being knocked off the ground into the middle of the ocean by an earthquake. I mean, that's a major quake. Spoosh! That's clearly a metaphor for bad things happening. It's not meaning literally that earthquakes are knocking mountains into the sea. First stanza. So the middle stanza is metaphorical. The first stanza contains massive metaphorical elements. And the third stanza. How do we know the third stanza is metaphorical? Or not to be taken literally, but figuratively. Has God destroyed all the weapons in the world? No. That has not happened. Now, you could perhaps say that it's prophetic, but there's no hint in the psalm to me that it's meaning to speak about the future. I read present tense in that psalm, and I read life situation. So clearly to me, this whole psalm, first stanza, middle stanza, last stanza, it's all an extended metaphor, right? Does that make sense to you? Okay, so now we have a question, like we might have in a literature class. Exactly what is it a metaphor for? How do we say this same metaphor in English today? Well, we can look in the first stanza and we see that this psalm is all about trouble. That God is always ready to help in times of trouble. What kinds of trouble? Trouble when the earth is shaken, mountains fall into the ocean depths, when seas roar in rage and the hills are shaken by violence. That's a lot of trouble. How might we say that exact same image of trouble today? My whole world is falling apart around me. That's the metaphor here. When my world is crumbling, God is ready to help in those times of trouble. When life is spun out of control, God is able and ready to help me. That's the metaphor that runs throughout this entire psalm. In fact, that's what I've been talking about this whole evening. What a coincidence. It's as though I picked the psalm, knowing what it talked about. Oh, wait, I did. Building block number two. So the entire psalm is an extended metaphor for stress and how we can live in the midst of a stressful or overwhelming situation when our world is falling apart around us. God's answer is not a plan, but a promise. It's not a program, but a person. Like, God's not sitting there saying, oh, you feel stressed? Let's deal with your time management skills. Here's the divine plan for planning your day, you know? Only $19.95 on QVC or whatever. You know, it's nothing like that. Now, stuff like, you know, planning, goal setting, prioritization, those are all important skills we need to learn in life. But that's not God's fundamental answer to the problem of stress or being overwhelmed. It's very important that we get that at the outset. God is not just another how-to book or a self-help guide. He does provide us practical guidance for our living, but he's about much more than that. He's about profounder realities. It would be as though God was standing next to my brother when my brother fell into that big, nasty, soupy, dead mammal floating water. And he's like, let's see if we can identify the root problem here. The root problem is you don't know how to walk along clay ledges. Let's start talking about how to do that. Well, meanwhile, my brother's Does what my brother needs root problem advice? No, what my brother needs is a hand to get out of the water. And the psalm says again and again and again that God is there with a hand extended to get us out of our overwhelming circumstances. Psalm number one, stanza number one, starts off with a statement of confidence that God is our strength and our refuge. Even though all this stuff is going on, we will not fear. Why? Music's going off. This is a tension that's been created by the psalm. We're thinking about it. God's our strength and refuge. Is that enough? The world is going crazy. If mountains, the most stable thing we can think of, cannot stand firm in the face of this onslaught, how can we, little mortals, go into stanza two? Because there is a river that brings joy to the city of God. What's the city of God? Well, if it's not a real city, it's something else. I would submit the most likely explanation is that it's the kingdom of God, what we would call today. The people of God gathered together. Where God's people are, his presence is. In fact, you yourself are a citizen of the city of God, the New Jerusalem. Our citizenship is in heaven, the Bible says, right? The city of God is where you are. The city of God is your life. And there is a river. What's the river? Well, the presence of God, the Spirit of God. That brings joy to the city of God. So that even though all this other stuff is going on, first stanza, mountains are being thrown into the ocean. The very hills are shaking with the force of the violence that is consuming the planet and the overwhelming troubles that are coming our way. This city will never be destroyed. This city will be able to withstand whatever comes its way. Why? Because God is there. And he will save it by morning. Trouble comes with the dawn, God will be there by 10 a.m. It's all going to work out because the city of God experiences the presence of God. Moves on to Psalm number three. Stanza number three. So first we start off with the whole world being consumed. We then go to, but there's an outpost of peace in the midst of the storm. And then God begins to leverage that outpost of peace and work it and resonate through that, reflect through that, echo through that to the entire world. And he uses the city of God to bring peace to a troubled culture, to a troubled planet, to a hurting people, so that he breaks every bow. He destroys every shield. He removes the weapons. And again, this is all metaphorical. What weapons might he be speaking of? I don't know for sure. I'd speculate things like stress, like anger, bitterness, guilt, shame, envy, conflict, the things that cause stress in life, that bring about the lack of joy and peace that God is promising here, he destroys those through the power of his Spirit. You can break the psalm into three parts. In fact, God did, by Selah. Go in. The first stanza is about God's power. You just write that off to the side if you want. God is powerful. That's the point. The whole world is being shaken, but God is in control. Second stanza is about God's presence. God is powerful, and God is here. God is with us. He's not just powerful and far off. He's right here for us. There's two phrases in here that are key. The Lord of hosts and the God of Jacob. The Lord Almighty. That literally, that is the Lord of the armies, the God of hosts, many massive multitudes of people around him. The God over all. The one, it says, who is supreme in the earth, right? Supreme over everything. Supreme over the nations. The God who is transcendent. And then it says right after that, the God of Jacob. Why? The God of the individual. The God who wrestles with each one of us in our trouble, as he did with Jacob at Peniel, I believe. Peniel. He began to wrestle with Jacob there. One-on-one, God came down into his life. And he touched Jacob at the point of his strength and converted it into a point of weakness in order that Jacob might rely on God all the more. And through that changed Jacob's life. And through changing Jacob's life, changed the nature of an entire nation. What was Jacob's other name? Israel. You may have heard that name before. Because one man wrestled with God and prevailed, which means he lost with dignity. Because he wrestled with God and prevailed, a whole nation was blessed. And because that nation was blessed, the whole world was blessed when Jesus came and lived and died as a Jew in the midst of that nation to reconcile the world to himself, to God. The God of hosts, the Lord Almighty, and the God of Jacob, the God of John, the God of Song, the God of Glenn, the God of Becky, the God of Karen, the God of each one of us, the God of us all, and the God of us as individuals. He's right there. God's power and God's presence for us together and for us as individuals. And the final stanza is about God's peace. God's power, God's presence, God's peace. That's God's solution to stress. Is changing our entire paradigm. Not about little, oh, if you learn to set your alarm clock 5 minutes earlier, you'll get to class, you'll have more time, you'll feel less hurried throughout your day. You and I know that's a lie. Work expands to fill all available time. Especially in a pressure cooker like Stanford, where we just feel like we got to try and keep up with the person next to us. We got to look good. We're like a duck. We try to float on top of the water, look all smooth and collected, look beneath the water, psh, turmoil, legs going like crazy, trying to keep ourselves afloat. God says, reframe your life. Look to me. Realize that I am your strength. I am your refuge. I am your source of peace. He says to us what he says to the world, be still. Be still. Does that sound familiar? Did anybody else say be still in the Bible? Jesus. The waves were crashing. The disciples were fearful for their lives that their boat would be swept. Now remember, these are professional fishermen. They know storms on the ocean. This is bad. They're thinking we're going down. The perfect storm kind of weather. And Jesus says, peace, be still. I don't know what storms you have in your life right now. I can guess. I'll probably be right on some of them. But I promise you that whatever storm you face, whether it be problem sets or homework, problems with your parents, problem with your roommates, conflict with a significant other, I don't know. God is bigger. And into that situation tonight, he says, peace, be still. I am supreme over all. I am supreme over your problem. My power is here for you. My presence will comfort you, and my peace will be your strength. That's the word of the Lord for each of us tonight. And I invite you to join me in prayer as I express gratitude to God for it. If I had to summarize this psalm right before I go to prayer, in just three simple phrases, I'd be hard-pressed to top Lloyd Ogilvie. He was the chaplain of the United States Senate until a few years ago. He said very simply, the Lord is on our side, stanza one. He is by our side, stanza two. And he gives us peace inside, stanza three. The Lord is on our side, by our side, and gives us peace inside. That's the message for each of us tonight. God, you are God in heaven. You are the God of all of us, and not just of us, but of the billion other people on planet Earth who call you Lord and Savior. And not just of them, but of the billions other who do not yet know you. You are God, whether we acknowledge you or not. And you are the Lord of the host of heaven, the mighty angel army. You supervise every star in the universe, uncountable though they are. You know every grain of sand on the sea. You are the Lord Almighty, supreme over all. And you are my Lord. You are not just a Lord who is magnificent and awesome. You are God who is personal and here. And you know every detail of my life. And amazing as it is to contemplate, I always have your full attention. In the midst of my homework, God, you're there with me. As I have bad dreams of stress and failing finals and whatnot, you're there with me. As I go to class, you're there with me. You are my shepherd. You know me by name. God, tonight I need you. I need to not just abstractly know that you are with me. I need to feel you with me. I need to not just appreciate your power, but to experience your presence. And with your presence, God, that precious peace that passes human understanding. You said your river will bring joy. I could use a dose of joy right now. You promised in your word that your joy will be my strength. I need strengthening. Give me joy by the power of your Holy Spirit. God, I cry out to you. I wait for you in patience. And I ask you to touch me.